Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we're going to help you get a jump start on your summer reading list, and we'll explore the legacy of a 17th century author who wrote an abolitionist novel at a time when that was practically unheard of. But first, we've had tons of conversations here on the show recently about the ongoing water shortage in the Valley and the various ways it impacts all aspects of life. South of the border, in the Mexican state of Sonora, the city of Hermosillo is dealing with many of the same issues. And KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky recently reported an illuminating series of stories about how drought is shaping life there. Nina joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for your work on this really interesting series. I wanted to start with actually the way it opens, which is you take us to a park where a lot of people have crowded into a very limited amount of shade. Tell us why you started there.
Yeah, I started there because this park is a pillar project by the state government, actually. You know, as Hermosillo is growing and growing, a lot of that growth is going out, sort of into the desert. It's expanding outwards instead of expanding upwards, sort of exacerbating a lot of this urban heat island effect that I know that, you know, folks in Phoenix
yes.
deal with too.
Sounds familiar.
totally. And so, you know, spaces like this, this park are really important, and they're, you know, people are crowded under the shade by this little lake. There's ducks. It's pretty idyllic, but it sort of feels like an oasis, right? In this big, sprawling kind of concrete city. And, you know, I think more and more there's a recognition here in Hermosillo that, you know, planting native plants and sort of like, you know, propagating spaces like this is really important. And so that's why I went out to talk to folks in this park.
So one of the things that was really interesting to me about this chapter, if you will, in the series that you did is, in addition to being a story about water, of course, it's also a story about growth. And Hermosillo mm-hmm. is growing at an extremely rapid rate, as you report in the story, faster maybe than even Phoenix.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say definitely to totally compare them, but Hermosillo between 2010 and 2020, within those 10 years, grew 20%. That's almost double the amount that Phoenix grew in that same time. So it's growing really fast. And, you know, it's the population is now pretty well over 900,000, probably closer to a million at this point. And, you know, it's just this big growing city that has, you know, a lot of the same growing pains as, like you said, Phoenix does.
Yes. Well, let's talk about some of those growing pains. One of the things that's happening is it's exposing some difficulties that the urban infrastructure is having in keeping track of the water. And in another section of your series, you talk about this social media campaign that the city has undertaken. Tell us about that social media campaign.
Yeah, so the city has this campaign called Cuida that is partially an educational campaign. You know, they're getting out into the schools, they're posting on social media. They're trying to sort of educate people about how to conserve household water. That's really important, Sam, because Hermosillo has a good amount of water that comes into the system, but almost 50% of that water is unaccounted for once it gets into the system. So some of it evaporates. You know, this is a big, hot, dry city.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of evaporation that happens from the water in the city systems, from its dams and reservoirs. But also a good proportion of the water that's unaccounted for is lost through inefficiencies in the system. So leaky municipal pipes, but also leaky household pipes. And that's a big issue because almost half of the city's residents, somewhere around half of the city's water users, don't have a water meter. So that means they pay this flat rate for water instead of paying for the water based on how much they use. So there isn't a huge incentive to save water at home. And, you know, a family might not even know that, like, you know, they have a big leak in their house or their toilet is running 24/7 if they're paying a flat rate for water. So a lot of water is lost that way. So the city is really trying to correct for that now. They've gotten 11,000 more households and businesses into the water meter program just this year. You know, they're going door to door to try to get people water meters and try to teach people how to conserve water at home and what to do if they have a big leak. So the city is sort of trying to correct for this issue in a way that might seem small, but, you know, water officials and water management experts in Hermosillo say is a really good way to start sort of accounting for a lot of the water waste that happens in the city.
Yeah. Well, and with that much water unaccounted for, you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, lastly, Nina, there's also the impact that all of this has on the more rural and agrarian communities surrounding Hermosillo.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last installment of your series, you take us to a small community called Banamichi. And among other people, we meet a farmer whose family is facing the prospect of potentially losing their family's farm. Why is that happening?
Yeah, so there's a couple things happening here, Sam. Drought is impacting everyone, but it's especially impacting farmers and ranchers. You know, ranching is pretty water intensive, and Francisco Maldonado, who's a rancher in Banamichi, also grows alfalfa, like a lot of the farmers around that area do, and that's water intensive. And so he hasn't been able to have the water that he needs these past couple of years of pretty intense drought here in Sonora, and so he's looking at the prospect of potentially selling his farm. That's even before this project that he's really worried about. The state and federal officials are planning to dam up the river just about 10 miles north of Banamichi. That project is sort of aimed at keeping a water supply, state officials say, for these small agrarian towns on the Rio Sonora, but also really designed to bring water into growing dry Hermosillo. And people in this town are really, really worried that this dam is going to leave them without water. You know, Francisco Maldonado said he's already facing the prospect of potentially having to sell his farm. And this dam project makes that possibility even more real for him.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. That is KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky reporting from Hermosillo. Nina, thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
Lots of Arizonans rent apartments, and lots of those leases include something called a crime-free lease addendum. They're intended to make apartment complexes safer and prevent crime from happening there. But a new investigation from the Arizona Republic finds they're not really having the desired effect. And in some cases, they're actually doing the opposite of what they're supposed to do. Hannah Dreyfus is an investigative reporter at the Republic and wrote the stories on this. She spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, and they started with what these crime-free addendums actually say.
Sure. So the crime-free addendum is a document that is actually in most rental agreements in Arizona. And if you were just to breeze through your lease agreement, you might see it. It looks like something that most people would say that has nothing to do with me, because it describes crimes as people would think of crimes, drug-related crimes, sex crimes, assault, gun-related crimes. And most people would go through that and say, well, I have no plans on shooting anyone in my apartment or assaulting anyone in my apartment or dealing drugs from this apartment. And so let me sign on the dotted line. This is not a problem for me. What people don't realize is that if you read the fine print, you'll see that what the crime addendum actually does is give landlords a much broader ability to define what is crime. And things that you wouldn't necessarily think of as crime can all of a sudden fall under that umbrella. So, for example, making a lot of noise could be considered criminal activity. Lighting up a joint could be considered criminal activity. Not registering your guests properly could be considered criminal activity.
And as you found during your reporting for this series, there have been people in Arizona who
have been evicted from their apartments over things that I think a lot of folks wouldn't necessarily consider criminal activity.
Sure. So I looked at incidents where folks were evicted from their apartments for activities that didn't receive a criminal charge, definitely didn't receive a criminal conviction, and in some cases didn't even involve police or law enforcement at all, meaning a landlord on their own independently made the decision that something was a crime and issued a 24-hour eviction notice to the tenant based on that independent determination.
How often did you find that was happening?
So it's interesting. We were able to get eviction data from Maricopa County, which looked at immediate evictions. Now, not every single immediate eviction is a criminal eviction, but any criminal eviction is an immediate eviction. And of overall evictions, that's a very small amount. But what we realized is that for people who are facing these evictions, the downhill consequences are really disastrous. So even though we're not seeing that many people kicked out of their apartment because of accusations that they're connected with the crime, the amount of harm for the person who does is extremely high.
What did you find in terms of whether or not having these kinds of provisions in leases actually reduces crime in those communities?
That's a fundamental question that we wanted to look at, because the concept, the underlying concept for the crime-free lease addendum was that we don't want criminals renting apartments.
Yeah, or you don't want crime happening in an apartment.
Exactly, which is something that anyone can get behind and anyone can understand. The question is, do these crime-free addendums actually reduce crime? And it's a fundamental question to understanding whether the justification for the adoption of this addendum, not just in Arizona, but in cities across the country, actually makes sense. So in Arizona, we decided to tackle that with data. And what we did is I systemically went through the cities in Arizona to see which ones had crime-free multi-housing programs, which means that they do use the lease addendum. And I looked at when they were implemented. And then what we did is we used data from the FBI to look at crimes in those areas. And what we found, and I worked with RAND Corporation, which is a public policy think tank, is that places that have implemented these crime-free policies do not see a reduction in crime. In fact, interestingly, we even saw a slight elevation in the numbers of robberies, assaults, and overall crime that were taking place in places that had adopted these crime-free policies.
Any sense as to why that might be, that places that had adopted these crime-free addendums might actually have more crime?
So that finding, because we were able to track that to only four cities, we weren't able to make a systemic guess as to the cause behind it. What we were able to say, and sort of the overall statistically significant finding, was that it didn't affect crime. We didn't want to make the jump, even though in the specific cities that we looked at, crime did increase with the crime-free addendum. We didn't want to make the jump, the analytic jump, to saying it systemically increases crime. But what we can say is that it systemically does not reduce crime. It definitely doesn't affect crime in the way that it was supposed to, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, so I guess that kind of raises the question that if a provision that is aiming to reduce crime is not, in fact, reducing crime, what's the point?
Well, that's exactly the question that I think police departments that have continued to put a lot of funds into these programs, which have several stages of implementation, need to start asking themselves, why are we continuing to use these programs? We understand why they came into being in the 90s. We understand why we adopted them. Now, decades later, we have to reanalyze, is that working? And if not, why are we continuing to invest our time, our officers' time, the time of our building managers into these programs?
Did anybody with whom you spoke for these stories talk about maybe trying to more clearly define what is a crime, or maybe change the standard for somebody to be evicted, that there would have to be, you know, a citation, or there'd have to be a law enforcement contact or something, as opposed to, as you described, sort of letting a landlord kind of on their own decide, okay, I think this is a crime, so you're out.
So in certain versions of the crime-free addendum, the standard of evidence that's supposed to be required for a landlord to say, a crime happened here is a preponderance of evidence standard. Now, that's a lower standard than in criminal court. Mm-hmm. In criminal court, you have a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. But in these cases, in theory, the landlord is supposed to have a preponderance of evidence that a crime took place. The problem is that when I spoke with lawyers who are helping specifically low-income Arizonans defend themselves against these allegations, that standard is not being met. And what you're seeing is landlords weaponizing this addendum to kick out people who they don't like and to threaten people with eviction whose behavior irks them in a certain way, as opposed to individuals where there's a preponderance of evidence that a crime took place.
Did the data show anything about who is being affected by this? Like, are there particular demographic groups or other groups of people that are finding themselves on the wrong side of this more often than others?
Yes. So we looked at the demographic breakdowns of who these policies affect. And what we found is that crime-free housing policies are more likely to affect renters who are Black and non-white. In the case of Black individuals, it's two times more likely that the places that they live will be subjected to these crime-free housing policies. Mm. Now, that could possibly be because in certain groups with lower socioeconomic groups might be depending more on rental properties than others who might be able to own homes. Either way, what we saw was a definite likelihood that these policies target Black and non-white households as opposed to white households.
All right. That is Hannah Dreyfuss, an investigative reporter with the Arizona Republic. Hannah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a Valley-based children's book author on her latest tale about overcoming the challenges of life with Tourette syndrome. But first, a few weeks back on the show, you may recall we had a conversation with one of the organizers of the Tesla takedown protests. These were gatherings at Tesla facilities around the Valley where people opposed to Elon Musk's work with the Department of Government Efficiency were trying to raise awareness about what they viewed as Musk's unconstitutional acts. And they were protesting with the explicit goal of damaging Tesla's stock price. Musk's ownership stake in Tesla is the source of a tremendous amount of his massive wealth. And the theory was that by lowering Tesla's stock price, the protests might compel him to step back from his political activities. Back in April, when Tesla reported Q1 earnings, Tesla shares were down 41%. Going back a few years, you might also recall when Bud Light ran an ad campaign with a trans actress named Dylan Mulvaney. In response, conservatives began boycotting Bud Light, resulting in a 20% drop in Anheuser-Busch's stock price. So you could argue that both of these protests were effective. But were they moral? That is the question that Saura Mascanale wants to answer. Mascanale is a professor in the U of A's Department of Political Economy and Moral Science. And both of the incidents I just mentioned would fall into what Mascanale calls market activism, people using their wallets to express their political beliefs. As Mascanale told me recently, she thinks the balance between free market and free society is something we need to think carefully about.
I think we live in a market democracy. And by that, I mean that modern democracies, at least in the Western world, are committed to both markets and democratic institutions. But with market activism, there is the risk that the market sphere may invade the political sphere. You might remember, I mean, there was like the North Carolina bathroom law.
Yes, this was a 2016 bill in North Carolina that banned municipalities from passing ordinances that protect LGBTQ plus people from workplace discrimination. And within that law was a requirement that schools and government offices restrict bathrooms to the gender a person is born with.
Yes. And something like 200 corporations threatened to boycott their business with the state.
Do you view the behavior of the corporations in that situation as moral?
We first have to ask why we are committed to markets, right? What is the moral justification for our commitment to markets? I think one of the most important justifications for the commitment of our society to markets is that they are supposed to make the pie bigger for all of us. That assumption, if you want, is based on a very idealized view of markets. Rather than acting competitively, which is the necessary assumption for the efficiency promise, they can act so to engage in what I call an unjust taking. So now to go back to your question about the boycott by corporations, I don't think that was morally permissible because they were outside this theoretical framework. It's not something that corporations can use to try to interfere with democratically adjudicated outcomes. Because whether we like those outcomes or not, if they were democratically adjudicated, we should accept them. And if we don't like them, try to change them democratically.
I see. So let me see if I'm clocking this correctly. And thank you for that explanation. Continuing to use this North Carolina situation as an example, in that case, state actors at the local level democratically put in place this bathroom law. It caused a lot of national controversy, which then prompted national corporations who may have been doing business in North Carolina but weren't necessarily based there to use their market power to change the democratically enacted laws of the state.
Correct.
I see.
And interestingly, you know, one of the theories of markets, the main theory is the allocative theories. Markets are good because they make the pie bigger for all of us. But at the time of Voltaire or the Scottish Enlightenment and Montesquieu, there was this do-commerce theory of markets. So markets were thought as a place where we could put our passions away so that we could like make good deals. And now the passions are back into the market.
Right.
And I think the risk is a polarization of the market that then can trigger an even bigger like spiral polarization in our everyday life.
That's very interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, what's happened is that there used to be, it sounds like, an agreed upon membrane between political life and economic life. And now that membrane has really eroded, and in particular in recent years.
Yes. And that is the big issue going on. And I don't think there is an easy fix. I don't think we will go back to a model, if you want, of market neutrality. And so we have to redefine probably what like that membering like means.
Yeah. So if you were to offer a definition, I don't want to put you too much on the spot here and ask you to solve what it sounds like for you is a very significant problem, but what would be a proper expression of that membrane?
So I think, you know, the analogy that I use is with self-defense. You know, like our commitment to markets is not independent, I believe, from government interventions designed to redress market failures. So government intervention against monopoly, government intervention against the excessive concentration of power. When that is lacking, is we are in a situation similar to when the state fails to protect our physical well-being. So when there is an attacker. So when the behavior of firms constitute what I call an unjust taking. So firms exploit individuals without compensating them. For example, there is firms can exploit some monopoly power to pay local workers less than the fair market price. I think in that case, it is morally permissible to use our wallet to defend ourselves. Now, like with self-defense, our ability to inflict a defensive harm, so to use market activism in this case against unjust firms, is not unconstrained. There needs to be like some requirements need to be satisfied. So a firm must be liable, of course. what I call market defense also need to be necessary. There are no alternatives, right? The government is failing to intervene. And so market defense is a necessary alternative. But then also needs to be proportional. So the defensive harm cannot be excessive.
So if I'm hearing you right, what you would like to see is, generally speaking, a world where the market yields to what seems to be the political will of the people, rather than people with excessive influence on the market applying pressure to the market in an attempt to shape the political will of the people.
Yes. I think markets are a great thing under certain assumptions. And when those assumptions are missing, then we enter into like a quite dangerous territory, because the ultimate risk here is what is referred to as market vigilantism. So you have a few people who can make decisions for all of us just because if you want, they have more money.
Well, Saura Mascanale is an assistant professor at the University of Arizona in the Department of Political Economy and Moral Science and the author of the paper, The Morality of Market Activism. Professor Mascanale, thank you for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Sam, for having me on the show. It was a great pleasure.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Summer always comes earlier than we would like it to here in Phoenix, but there are some benefits to that. For example, we get a jump start on building our summer reading lists. Silver lining. In other places, it'll be another month or two before people start thinking about the books they want to curl up with to beat the heat, but we get to, or maybe have to, do that right now. Joining me with some recommendations is Mark Athatakis, a Phoenix-based journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, many other places. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start with, there's a new biography of James Baldwin that is out. It's by Nicholas Boggs. And, you know, we see James Baldwin quotes a lot, like on T-shirts and posters and things, which can make it feel like we already know a tremendous amount about him. But if I'm not mistaken, this is the first significant biography of him in some time.
Yes. And we have a habit, I think, of simplifying a lot of authors like James Baldwin. And this is the first major biography of him in about three decades. And the subtitle of it is A Love Story. And part of Boggs's goal with this book is to look at James Baldwin through the filter of his relationships, his affairs, the people that he cared for. And that is intended to reveal a different side of him. And Boggs uncovered previously unearthed writings, looking through the archives at the Yale Library and other locations. And it creates a fuller portrait of who he is.
It seems like an interesting lens for approaching Baldwin, who is, in the aggregate, so well known for his ideas, these philosophical pronouncements that he made that are so profound and moving, but getting to understand his inner life seems like a pretty fresh perspective.
Well, he always operated on two levels. There was the author of The Fire Next Time, which was more of a Jeremiad, but he's also the author, obviously, of Giovanni's Room, which is one of the pioneering LGBTQ novels as well. So understanding James Baldwin means understanding both of those elements of him.
Let's shift now to, there's a new book by Ocean Vuong. And you actually recently talked to Ocean about this book for Kirkus. Tell us about this book.
So this is his second novel. His first novel, called On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, was much acclaimed when it came out in 2017. And this one, you know, there's a dearth of working class American novels. And this novel is largely set in what you and I would recognize as a Boston market. And exploring the notion of, if your real family is fractured, how do you create a family that you're basically thrust into, the workplace environment?
Let me just clarify. You mean Boston Market, like the restaurant?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. So, and he's talked about how he worked in these places growing up and was really interested in the idea of about how do we build relationships and how do we build almost familiar relationships with people when we don't know who they are, and we know them first because we have work tasks.
Wow. Well, shifting out of this particular style of writing, if we could, Mark. I wanted to also talk about Alberto Rios's new collection of poetry, Every Sound is Not a Wolf. Tell us about this collection.
Alberto Rios, obviously, he was a former Arizona poet laureate and is a veteran poet writing in a variety of forms. This particular collection is made up entirely of poems that are couplets and focused on boyhood, the desert, and interested in themes of delicacy and resilience. And to your point about earlier about how we get a jump on things in the summer heat here in Arizona, there is one poem of his in this collection that speaks pretty much directly to that. And I could read it if you like.
I would love to have you read it.
Sure. So the poem is called One More Sonoran Summer. Here, when the first 100-degree day arrives, someone wins a contest and they're happy. Everyone else is lost, however, and knows 100 degrees is just the start. 110 feels much the same. When it comes, and it does, it most certainly does. No lithe, impressive dodgeball move here. One newspaper winner again, but then the rest of us. The humor wears thin, as do the constant complaints, finally, about how unbelievably, ridiculously hot it is. So simply what follows, however, is our lives. The regular us, albeit slower, in hotter cars and sweating. But us. Professors, miners, astronomers, librarians, candy makers. We go on in this place, this desert, so full of apparently nothing. No skyscrapers out there, only cactus. No freeways but arroyos. This desert, so full of apparently nothing. But that trick is itself the great mirage of the Sonoran Desert, along with the cholla and orange trees, the iguanas, the thunderstorms, tortoises, turquoise, and tarantulas. We are here. We have always been here. We will be here. We stay inside. We move slowly. We go where we must. We, too, are some of the animals of the desert, this whole world, baying at the moon and marveling at the jackrabbit's ears.
We stay inside. We move slowly. We go where we must.
Yes.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, we have just about a minute left, Mark. Let's close out with the new novel by Gary Steingart, who I know is a favorite of yours.
Oh, absolutely. And one of our funniest writers and one of our most socially astute writers as well. And so this novel is titled Vera or Faith. It comes out in July. And it is a take on the Henry James story, What Maisie Knew, which is told from the perspective of a young child. And so Gary Steingart is an expert at fracturing and fragmented families and finding the humor in it. So telling that from the perspective of a 10-year-old is something that he was practically born to do.
Well, some fodder for your reading lists with Mark Athatakis this morning. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Guggenheim Foundation has announced their 100th class of fellows, and one of them is playwright and ASU professor Larissa Fasthorse. She's planning to use the stipend from her fellowship to continue a project she's been doing with the Public Theater in New York, creating a theatrical adaptation of one of the first English language novels. The novel is called Orinoco, and it was written in 1688 by a woman named Aphra Behn. Fasthorse was on the show a few months ago talking about her adaptation of Peter Pan, where she had to navigate the tricky task of humanizing the female and indigenous characters in that story, which meant changing some fundamental elements of it, which generations of audiences have gotten used to hearing in a very specific way. Orinoco, Fasthorse told me recently, presents a very different set of challenges.
The novel itself is bonkers. Like, it is out there. There's a lot. But our process is going to be with my longtime collaborator, Michael John Garces, who's a fellow professor of practice with me at ASU. We are going to, and have been, doing a community engaged process. We're interviewing and talking with folks who feel that they are descendants in some way of the themes of the novel. So far it's been a lot of indigenous folks. In the New York area, it's been folks that are descendants from enslaved people, that sort of thing. And we're, you know, seeing where they think maybe some of these themes from the novel may still resonate today or be important to their community to uplift.
Could you give a brief summary of what happens in the original story of Orinoco?
Sure. Yeah. So Orinoco is story that's told as if it's a first person account. So it's in the first person. So it's told as if this woman is experiencing this journey where she goes to Suriname and meets this enslaved person who was formerly an African prince in Ghana and has been, well, all people have been wrongfully enslaved, of course, but he had been betrayed specifically for, you know, by his own family in some way. So she hears the character, the main character in this novel, hears the whole story of what happened to this man, this Prince Orinoco, and how he ended up in Suriname enslaved. And then it continues with what happens there, where he ends up meeting his wife, who was also enslaved, and they end up re-meeting in Suriname. He thought she was dead and finds her there. And there's also a rebellion of the enslaved folks in Suriname who pair up with the indigenous people.
So these are all things that are always revolutionary to write about, but seem to be particularly revolutionary in 1688.
Yes.
How, in your opinion, were these themes dealt with in the original text? And what stands out to you about the way that the author, Ephra Bain, approached it?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously from our contemporary eyes, we can look at it and be like, ooh, wow. I mean, she spends, you know, two full pages describing this man's body, right? So there's that, which is like, you know, one, go her, but also it's a little, you know, the way that she's tokenizing this human is not great. But also, if you look at the time, many people would argue there's also one of the very first abolitionist, English language abolitionist pieces of literature, that it was really saying, you know, the slavery thing went really badly, and that there are some good white folks and some good enslavers, but mostly they're like, they're not good people. That was pretty revolutionary in the time.
Yes, to write a novel that questions slavery and invokes the humanity of enslaved people during a time of widespread slavery, that seems pretty remarkable.
And to be a woman doing it, you know.
Yeah. So can you share anything about what you're hearing in these community listening sessions that stands out for you?
Yeah, we had a group that the public brought together, primarily folks that consider themselves probably descendants of enslaved people that were brought here against their will, right? And it was interesting because a lot of the folks, you know, that we're dealing with on this project were worried, and what are they going to think? Are they going to be upset? People were feeling a little like we should apologize that everyone dies, especially the main characters who are enslaved people. And we're like, oh yeah, tell this. Yeah, everybody should die. And then we're like, oh, okay. because, you know, I think similar to myself, like coming from a Native American perspective, right? We're like, no, people need to know what really happened.
I wanted to ask you, you know, when we spoke previously about your work adapting Peter Pan, you said at the time that you were literally worried that the project might, quote, end your career.
yeah, I was.
because it, you know, it's such a famous and beloved text and people have all these associations with it. And Orinoco, no disrespect to Ephra Bain, it's not quite in the same category.
No, it's definitely not. I'm not getting angry DMs about me adapting this.
yeah. What is that like for you creatively? I mean, does that give you more wiggle room? How does that resonate for you in terms of the challenge of finding the right expression of this?
More freedom, for sure. This adaptation, and part of it was, you know, originally the public had asked me to do a classical adaptation. That was the assignment, and I was like, I'm not putting my name next to Shakespeare. Like, it makes me nuts that so often Black and Brown folks have to put their name next to Shakespeare's or another great white man to be considered, you know, legitimate and you've made it. And I just didn't want that to happen. And so this novel, instead, is still a classical piece, still the same period. You know, I was really excited to be able to adapt a woman's voice instead.
It strikes me that with Ephra Bain, it's particularly interesting because in addition to the fact that she is not Shakespeare or a figure like that, there's also very little that's known about who she really was at all, right? Yeah. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of mystery surrounding her origins.
There's a lot unknown. And I think that's fairly common, right? I think we're lucky that we even know that she was a woman, right? Because so often in that time, you know, these women had to write under a pseudonym or that she made a female main character. Like often, again, at that time, it would have been a man doing all of this. You know, it would she would have hidden under you know, like, well, this is okay because a man, it's a man's point of view, you know what I mean? Or it's a male story. But there is a lot of mystery and there's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of speculation about the first personness of the story. And what that came from, what sort of things she actually participated in her life regarding enslaved people and travel. So there's a lot of speculation that I'm actually still just getting into myself.
I could imagine there being this sort of inverse pressure with somebody like Aphra Behn, where if you want to adapt Shakespeare, one of the things that I it seems like you can kind of count on is like, sure, granted, we all love Shakespeare. Everybody respects Shakespeare. We don't have to elevate Shakespeare. But with a writer like Aphra Behn, who's not as well known, I could imagine there being some pressure to, I don't know, not want to stray too far from what she did so that more people know her name. Is that something you're navigating at all?
Well, I am now. Thanks, Sam.
Oops, sorry.
I wasn't until this moment. No, honestly, because we're doing it in this unusual way with the input of contemporary communities, you know, it could end up being exactly the same for all I know. You know, I don't actually know yet. It could end up being set, you know, on the island of Manhattan. It could end up being set, you know, so many places. I don't know. I really trust this process. Michael John and I always say that our process is our art form as much as the final thing is.
Well, Larissa Fasthorse is a playwright, a choreographer, a professor of practice at ASU, and one of the latest Guggenheim Foundation fellows for her eventual adaptation of Aphra Behn's Orinoco. Professor Fasthorse, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate talking with you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
A Valley-based children's book author is out with a new book, and it's a spin-off of sorts, The Beat I Drum. Tells the story of Connor Bradley, who appeared in earlier books by Dusty Bowling, as the best friend of another protagonist, Avon Green. In this book, Connor is starting a new high school, has recently moved into a new apartment in a new part of town, and is dealing with his father, who's trying to come back into Connor's life. Also, Connor has Tourette syndrome. Dusty Bowling spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about her new book, and they started with why she decided to focus on Connor and show us his life.
So some people will probably be familiar with my two earlier books, Insignificant Events in the Life of a Cactus and Momentous Events in the Life of a Cactus, which are told from the perspective of Connor's best friend, Avon Green. So people really like that character and they liked her best friend, Connor Bradley, who this book is about. And so I had the idea when I was finishing up the second book about Avon to write a whole story about her best friend just because people really liked the character, and so do I.
Was there something about being able to expand on who he is and, in his case, his struggles that appealed to you?
Yes, he's a very special character to me, actually. He was first inspired by my husband and daughters who all have tic disorders. Now, a lot of people will probably be familiar with Tourette syndrome. Unfortunately, Tourette syndrome has been really badly stereotyped for a very long time in books and especially movies as always being people shouting bad words. So when I had the idea to write Avon's story, Avon is actually, if you're not familiar with those books, she's a girl who was born without arms. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write a story about this girl with this pretty significant disability, but not have it be about the disability. I wanted it to be about her and who she is as a person and her sense of humor and her talents and all these things, and not have it be this serious, solemn story like so many stories I had read that featured characters with disabilities. I wanted it to be something different. And as I was starting to write about Avon's character, my daughter, who's 21 now, she was 11 at the time, she was just starting to have tics. And so she has really severe motor tics where she twists her neck and she twists her ankles and her wrists and taps her fingers and scrunches up her face. And it causes her a lot of physical pain, a lot of muscle pain, and also a lot of emotional pain from people always telling her, stop doing that. Why are you scrunching up your face? Why are you doing that? And then the pain that comes with her having to tell people you know, I can't stop. It's a tick. I have Tourette syndrome. And so many people saying back to her, oh, no, no, you don't have that. I know what that is. That's when people shout bad words and things like that. So the stereotyping of Tourette syndrome has gotten so bad that even when people meet someone with real Tourette syndrome, they sometimes don't even believe them that they have it. And so I decided at that time to put Connor into Aven's story simply because I wanted to have a more authentic, accurate representation of what Tourette syndrome is for a lot of kids. But I just fell so much in love with him that I decided he needed his own story.
Well, so when you were writing his story, were you trying to do for him what you did for Aven and not make it sort of about Tourette syndrome, but make it about a child who has it, but also about his life, sort of the ups and downs of, in his case, a kid starting a new school?
Right. So this story is about so many things. It is that aren't related to his Tourette syndrome. It's about having to start over at a brand new high school where you know nobody. So I think starting in high school for any kid at a new school where you are starting completely from scratch with no friends is terrifying for all children. So that's a really relatable problem that Connor is having in the story. And a big part of why he has to start over at a new high school is because he and his mom have moved across the city in order to be closer to his father, who he has a really contentious relationship with. So he doesn't want to reconnect with his father. His parents got divorced a couple of years ago, which I also think a lot of children can, of course, relate to. And I think all of these problems are really relatable to all children, not just children with Tourette syndrome. So there's a lot going on in the book that doesn't have anything to do with that. Although there is definitely a storyline about him connecting with this music teacher and learning how to play an instrument. You could probably tell which one it is from the title, in order to, as a kind of almost help, a therapy for his tics, because music, playing musical instruments, singing, all kinds of musical therapies are really good for kids with tic disorders.
I'm interested in what you said about having aspects of Connor's life that are relatable in terms of, you know, his parents split up, he's starting a new high school and the difficulties of that. I wonder if in some ways that is a way to help readers and other kids who are, or adults who are reading this book, to also sort of maybe understand the thing that is less relatable to them in terms of Tourette syndrome.
Definitely. I think finding that common ground with another person, look, hey, we're not different in every way. We actually have all these commonalities. We share all these things, these life experiences. I really think that helps kids and people in general to connect with people and be more understanding and empathetic about the things they don't have personal experiences with.
Yeah. So in your past books, your home state has played a fairly sizable role in many of them. I'm wondering in what ways Phoenix or Arizona plays a role in this book.
So yeah, I tried to bring in some things I love about the city. A lot of my books take place like out in the desert, but mm-hmm. the Cactus books definitely, and then this one now take place in the city. And so I try to bring in some of those quirky things that I love. So there's a storyline within the book about where a friend of Connor's family worked, this restaurant they own, and it's a pizza place where they have this huge organ. It's called Organ Pipe Pizza, and it's based on a place, a real restaurant in Chandler that I've been to. And so there's definitely, Phoenix has its own perks and strange things that I don't think exist really anywhere else. So I'm always trying to touch on those fun things that I love about Arizona, whether it's out in the desert or in the city.
Well, I thought it was interesting, even just at the very beginning of the book, you reference Connor's first day at his new school and his dad comes to pick him up. I hope I'm not giving too much away here. They sort of have this disagreement about whether or not the dad is going to drive Connor home. And you reference how hot it is, which is obviously a very sort of Phoenix thing, that school starts when it's still unbelievably hot outside. And it almost seems like you make the heat outside almost like a metaphor for how they're feeling about each other, even when they get in the car and sort of have this very uncomfortable ride back to Connor's apartment.
Absolutely. The heat definitely plays a role in a lot of my stories, because how can you not think about the heat in a Phoenix summer? It's overwhelming. And anyone who's ever been here over the summer knows how incredibly hot it gets, especially inside of a car. And so I definitely wanted to, I guess you could say, turn up the heat on that scene where they're butting heads. And, you know, there has to be always a lot of conflict in a story. And definitely Connor and his dad have a ton of conflict in this story. And so that is played out in so many different scenes and ways until they also have to find a common ground where they can meet at, just like so many other people.
Yeah. All right. That is Valley-based author Dusty Bowling. Her new book is called The Beat I Drum. Dusty, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
It was so nice to talk to you too. Thank you, Mark.
Well, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Lots of stories about books that explore worlds you might not be familiar with on the show today. If the real world is feeling a little exhausting, maybe pick one of them up. We thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be right back here tomorrow at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.